Minnesota news here on the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi on Thursday, June 5. Coming up, former Twin Cities Archbishop Harry Flynn talks about his handling of abuse claims. More on the possible innocence of a Minnesota man who spent decades behind bars for murder. Should the amount of alcohol sold in Minneapolis restaurants be adjusted? And capturing the water runoff on a golf course. First, the mother of a 17-year-old boy who was shot and killed last weekend in North Minneapolis made a plea for peace yesterday. Nehemiah Steverson was shot early Sunday morning. His mother, Angela Steverson, spoke at a vigil not far from where her son was shot.
And I'm so sick of us raising children that hate one another because they're not getting love at home.
Yeah, all right.
We're so busy loving on another man or loving on another woman that we're not loving our kids.
The vigil was interrupted when a fight broke out. Police on the scene used a chemical irritant to break up the fight, and the vigil continued. A new report by the state's fire marshal provides more details about a Minneapolis fire that killed five children, but the cause of that February fire is still unknown. Brad Williams reports.
According to the report, the fire started in a middle room on the second floor of the upper duplex where Troy Lewis lived with his eight children. Investigators found what they described as an unknown melted mass in the room. The mass was removed by a forensic electrical engineer to be x-rayed. Lewis has said he'd complained to the property owner about a lack of heat in the apartment and that he'd used the oven and a space heater to compensate for broken radiators in the unit. Landlord Paul Bertelson has said Lewis never raised any concerns about the heat. City records show an inspector cited the property for lack of electricity in August and threatened to condemn it. The inspector also noted additional electrical problems. The city marked those violations as resolved in September. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Metro Transit has beefed up its police force to prepare for the launch of the Twin Cities' newest light rail system. Laura Ewan has more.
Metro Transit Police Chief John Harrington says the agency is dedicating 22 officers to the Green Line connecting St. Paul to Minneapolis. Their duties will consist of walking not only the trains, but also the platforms. He says the new strategy for officers to roam the stops grew out of feedback from the public.
Where folks said they were most concerned, not so much that where they had most victimization, but where they felt like they were more fearful was when they were waiting for the train or waiting for the bus. And so I believe that visible police presence at those stops and at those stations is an important part of reducing fear among our customers.
The Green Line opens for its first customers 1 week from Saturday. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Twin Cities job market continues to show signs of improvement. As Matt Sepik reports, online job postings indicate increasing demand for workers.
Every month, the Conference Board and Economic Research Group calculates the supply and demand for labor based on the jobless rate and the number of want ads posted on the internet. The Help Wanted Online Index says nationwide there were about 200 job seekers for every 100 job openings in April. The situation is better for job seekers in Minnesota, especially the Twin Cities metro area, where 119 people are chasing every 100 jobs. Steve Hine heads the state's Labor Market Information Office.
It's not surprising considering our long history of being a relatively low unemployment rate state that we also rank well by this particular measure.
Minnesota has the 10th tightest job market among the states. Oil-rich North Dakota is in first place. It had twice as many job postings in April as there were people available for work. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is proposing its most wide-ranging regulation of farm fertilizer use in the state. The agency wants to restrict the fall application of nitrogen to protect groundwater. Here's our Mark Style.
After the harvest, farmers like to apply fertilizer for next year's crop because they have time for the chore before freeze-up. But this means the fertilizer is susceptible to several problems before it's absorbed by crops the next spring. With heavy rains and snowmelt, it can leach into groundwater or run off into streams and lakes. It can even vaporize into the air. As part of an ongoing process to draft new standards for managing nitrogen fertilizer in the state, the Agriculture Department says it will begin developing new rules to restrict fall nitrogen application. The main target will be farm fields where there's a high potential the nitrogen could reach groundwater, where it poses a health threat to pregnant women and young children. Mark Style, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
A group of Democratic leaders will hold a fundraiser this month for an organization working to elect Hillary Clinton for president. Tom Scheck reports.
The fundraising invitation features a list of several well-known DFL politicians, including Senator Amy Klobuchar, Governor Dayton, and St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman. The fundraiser, held at the office of DFL donor Vance Opperman on June 18th, will raise money for the Super PAC, Ready for Hillary. The invitation also says the group will launch the organization Minnesotans Ready for Hillary. Ready for Hillary is not affiliated with Clinton, but includes staffers who worked for Clinton's 2008 presidential run. The PAC is considered to be laying the groundwork for Clinton's possible presidential run. The list of DFL supporters also shows there's a large number of active Democrats who are ready to support Clinton's campaign in Minnesota if she does run for president in 2016. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis-based Target is getting pressure to ban firearms in its stores in the wake of gun rights advocates bringing rifles into stores in Texas and several other states. Martin Moylan has more.
A group that has lobbied other prominent retailers to prohibit guns in stores wants Target to enact a ban. The website of an organization called Open Carry Texas has a photo of an activist in a Target store with an assault rifle slung over his shoulder. The group spokesman, Tove Henderson, says it would be a bad idea for Target to ban guns.
I wouldn't feel safe taking my family into an establishment where the only potential person armed is a criminal.
Henderson says his group is trying to persuade the Texas legislature to make the open carrying of handguns legal. The thinking is, if rifles could be carried openly, why not handguns? Target would only say safety is the company's top priority. The retailer doesn't sell guns and follows all applicable laws. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Former Archbishop Harry Flynn testified under oath he doesn't remember most of the decisions he made about clergy sexual abuse cases. His deposition, released by victims' attorneys yesterday, marked the first time Flynn had to answer questions about his handling of abuse cases since reports of a cover-up last fall. The testimony is part of a lawsuit that says the Archdiocese created a public nuisance by keeping information on abusive priests secret. Madeline Barron reports.
Flynn served as the Archbishop of St. Paul in Minneapolis from 1995 to 2008. In nearly 4 hours of sworn testimony last month, Flynn professed few memories of those days. Victims' attorney Jeff Anderson grilled Flynn on many priests now known as abusers, including Father Joseph Heitzer. A top deputy had told Flynn in a 2002 memo that Heitzer was perhaps the most abusive priest who ever served in the Archdiocese.
I'm looking at that name, it seems to me, for the first time ever.
The next is Alfred Longley, several parishes listed. What can you tell us about what was known about his abuse history?
Once again, I'm looking at that name for the first time.
More than 130 times, the former archbishop said he couldn't remember how he handled even the most high-profile allegations against priests. The 81-year-old denied any dementia and blamed his memory loss on old age. Flynn's testimony was all the more striking because he's well known as a national leader on the issue of clergy sexual abuse. He guided the Catholic Church out of a national scandal in 2002 and even drafted the landmark church policy approved by U.S. bishops, the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. It was that national role that Flynn said kept him from paying more attention to what was happening in his own archdiocese.
I was out of the diocese a great deal doing talks on the Charter and trying to get dioceses on board, and it's unfortunate that we did not pay more attention to this as a result.
The former archbishop has come under intense scrutiny in recent months after reports by NPR News showed Flynn kept some abusers in ministry and classified others as medically disabled because of their sexual attraction to children. Flynn authorized secret payments to several abusers he considered disabled. Anderson asked Flynn about the payments, especially those to Father Gilbert Gustafson, who pleaded guilty in 1983 to sexually abusing a teenage boy.
What message do you think that sends to the victims that he abused, that he's receiving payments for having victimized them?
I don't know, but what message would it send to the world if we threw these people out on the street without any difficulty, without any assistance?
If they were thrown into jail
that
and
would be
reported to the police?
That would be something else.
That would send a powerful message,
yes,
wouldn't it?
Flynn said he never turned over files to police. Anderson asked him why not.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Flynn has largely faded into the background, while current Archbishop John Nynsted remains at the center of the scandal. In his deposition, Nynsted tried to shift the blame back onto the Flynn administration. In brief remarks after a mass at an Edina parish in December, Nynsted claimed to be blindsided by the scandal.
When I arrived here 7 years ago, one of the first things I was told is that this whole question of clerical sexual abuse had been taken care of. I didn't have to worry about it. And unfortunately, I believe that.
Flynn said under oath that he doesn't recall Nynsted ever asking him about clergy abuse. A spokesman for the Archdiocese declined to comment.
Madeline Barron for us. The Minneapolis Police Department and the Hennepin County Attorney's Office are taking another look at the case of convicted Minneapolis serial killer Billy Glaze, a day after the Innocence Project filed a petition asking that Glaze get a new trial. Innocence Project lawyers say new DNA evidence found at two of the crime scenes exonerates Glaze and points to another killer. The victims were three women raped and murdered in the late 1980s. Tricia Volpe, who reports for NPR News and Care 11, talked about it with Tom Cran.
It sounds like authorities here are taking these new findings pretty seriously.
Yeah, that's right. Care 11 talked to a Minneapolis police commander who says investigators are following up on all available leads. And this is a case nearly three decades old, so that isn't easy. Police are interviewing people, reviewing evidence, and working with the county attorney's office to figure out what's next. For its part, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office now has two prosecutors looking at the case of Billy Glaze. First, the Innocence Project files its petition asking for a new trial. And the county attorney's office now gets a chance to respond to that, and ultimately a judge will decide.
So, Tricia, today I understand you've been gathering a lot of reaction, talking to people who were key players in the original police investigation and the trial back more than 25 years ago.
Yeah, a trip down memory lane for some of these folks, and really not a good memory. These were horrific crime scenes, and when the serial killer was on the loose, the community lived in fear. I spoke today with John Locks, who was deputy Minneapolis police chief when the killings happened and head of police investigations. He says police did what they could with the tools they had at the time, and everything pointed to Billy Glaze.
We had to follow the rules and make sure that we're not taking shortcuts just out of revenge, or we got to get somebody. No, we got to get the right guy. And we thought we had the right guy. I'm still not convinced completely that we don't have the right guy, but there's certainly enough evidence being uncovered that we need to take an in-depth second look.
Locks points to the advances in technology to investigate crimes, DNA analysis specifically, and how far it's come. If someone else's DNA was found at the crime scene, he says that's strong evidence.
And what about the lawyer who represented Glaze at the trial?
Well, Mike Kolich is now a top Twin Cities criminal defense attorney. I actually showed him some of the old video of interviews he did with reporters at the time of Glaze's trial. Kolich says this case has always stuck with him, and he argued during the trial that there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict Glaze beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no DNA analysis available at the time to help his case, but he says the new revelations are compelling.
If we had the same information that they apparently have today, do I think the outcome would be different? I do. It was a horrible thing that happened to the women. It's just equally as horrible for a man to go to prison for something he didn't do and for the better part of his life.
So what's next here in this legal process?
As I mentioned, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office gets a chance to respond to the petition filed by the Innocence Project. They asked for a new trial because, legally speaking, that's what they can do. But what Innocence Project lawyers really want is for the charges against Glaze to be dismissed and the man behind bars for nearly 30 years to be released. No doubt, Tom, this could be a very long process.
Tricia, thank you.
You're welcome.
Tricia Volpe and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. Minneapolis voters will decide this fall whether to remove restrictions on the amount of alcohol some city restaurants are allowed to sell. The Minneapolis Charter Commission last night moved to hold a referendum on the so-called 70-30 rule, which says restaurants in residential neighborhoods have to make the bulk of their revenue selling food. As Curtis Gilbert reports, the ballot question is part of a larger movement to restructure the city's alcohol regulations.
Do you have anything like a Pilsner kind of situation?
Yeah, I have a lot.
Kevin Scott just ordered his third beer at Pat's Tap on Nicollet. He also had some curried mussels and zucchini cakes with aioli. But booze made up more than half his tab.
I would guess my drinks were $15 and my food was $10. So are they like breaking the law right now?
There's nothing illegal about having one patron spend more on booze than food. But the trouble is, he's not the only one. And Kim Bartman, who owns Pat's Tap, says that messes up her ratio.
We are currently running afoul of the ratio here at around 50-50.
The ratio at Pat's Tap is supposed to be 60% food, 40% alcohol. At some of Bartman's other restaurants, alcohol sales aren't allowed to exceed 30% of revenues. Bartman says the ratios are hard to hit because they're affected by forces beyond her control.
You know, I'm not in charge of the world commodity scene, so I can't control my alcohol prices, my microbrew prices, the price of corn and barley, and I certainly can't control the price of beef and pork and chicken. So those percentages just don't make sense, and they don't accomplish what they set out to accomplish.
And Bartman isn't the only business owner struggling with the percentages. Over the last 4 years, Minneapolis has issued about 50 citations for restaurants that exceeded them. City Council member Elizabeth Glidden says as the dining public gravitates toward pricier craft beers, fancy cocktails, and high-end wine, it's become tougher for restaurants to comply with the limits on alcohol revenue.
The fact that you can't meet that may not mean that you are a bad restaurant or not managing things properly. It says to us as the city, is there another mechanism that is workable that makes sure restaurants are acting like good neighbors that is modernized?
Glidden is co-sponsoring a proposal to do away with the ratios altogether. It will include a new way of differentiating restaurants from bars, and it will set standards designed to ensure staff are well-trained and businesses are managed responsibly. The council can easily repeal the limits for restaurants like Pat's Tap, whose alcohol sales are currently capped at 40% of revenue. But about 70 restaurants face an even stiffer 30% restriction set forth in the city charter. Removing that ratio will take a referendum, which will appear on the ballot this November, thanks to last night's Charter Commission vote. Charter Commissioner Todd Ferrara says he supports lifting the restrictions, even though, as a neighborhood activist in the 1980s, he fought hard to keep his neighborhood dry.
People were afraid that alcohol would affect their neighborhoods in a very adverse way. Now, the community, our society, and restaurants have changed.
Ferrara says alcohol carries far less stigma than it used to. The Charter Commission vote was unanimous. Only one person spoke against it at a public hearing, and 14 neighborhood groups have passed resolutions supporting the repeal. The lack of opposition surprises Tracy Toomey. She's an epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota, and she specializes in alcohol policy. Toomey says it's easy to predict what will likely happen if the city reduces restrictions.
My guess is more alcohol is going to be sold. And if we increase availability of alcohol, we probably will increase problems.
Toomey says what's happening in Minneapolis is part of a national trend toward less alcohol regulation. Statistics show alcohol consumption has been on the rise since the mid-1990s. It's a trend she sees as troubling.
Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis, from excess booze to excess rain. All the rain that we've seen over the past couple of weeks has some people asking, couldn't we try to capture some of that stormwater and save it for later this summer when the grass starts to die off? Well, one place where stormwater reuse makes a lot of sense is on golf courses. And as part of our Beneath the Surface project examining the state's groundwater, Elizabeth Dunbar reports a couple of East Metro golf courses are already trying it.
You couldn't ask for a better day to play golf at Prestwick in Woodbury. After the foursome moves on, the golf club's superintendent, Dave Kazmarek, hits the trails in his cart, showing me around the lush, rolling turf.
With all the rain, it's plenty green.
Kazmarek hasn't had to turn on the sprinklers yet this year to keep the greens living up to their name. But when it dries out over the next few months, this golf course will likely pump millions of gallons of groundwater into its irrigation system. Across Minnesota, roughly 500 golf courses tap billions of gallons of groundwater each year. Generally, that hasn't been seen as a problem. But in some areas of the state, groundwater and surface water levels have dropped dramatically, and everyone from cities to farmers to golf courses are worried about it. The Department of Natural Resources is monitoring this area in the north and east Twin Cities suburbs closely. If state officials decide groundwater pumping needs to slow down, it could affect all users, including golf courses. That's one reason why Kesmerick is so excited about Prestwick's new stormwater pond. It collects runoff from nearby County Road 19.
From our perspective, what we get out of the deal is we get an alternative water source on our golf course to help alleviate us pulling water out of the aquifer for irrigation to the tune of roughly anywhere from a quarter to hopefully maybe even a third of the water that we use to be able to come from the source. So for everybody, it's just a win-win situation.
A similar project is underway at the Onika Ridge Golf Course in Hugo, another northeast metro suburb.
There's not a course that you couldn't do this on.
Jack McKenzie is executive director of the state association that represents golf course superintendents. They're the turf experts who are in charge of making the courses both beautiful and functional. McKenzie says directing stormwater to golf courses will clean up lakes, put less strain on aquifers, and return some of that would-be runoff back to the ground.
If people are willing to look at this as an opportunity, you know, environmentally, holy cow, this is great. It's a destination for water reclamation.
Water supply planners agree there's great potential to reuse stormwater runoff. A 2011 Metropolitan Council report says about 70% of rain and snow in the Twin Cities becomes runoff when it falls on rooftops, parking lots, and streets. Rather than seeping into the ground, most of it ends up in our lakes and rivers. And golf courses aren't the only places where some of this water can be reused. A few communities are using stormwater to keep baseball and soccer fields green or to irrigate public landscapes. The Minnesota Twins have an elaborate system for reusing stormwater, and a system is being designed for the new St. Paul Saints Stadium. Brian Davis says the challenge is figuring out how to collect the stormwater and then how to store it. Davis is an environmental scientist for the Metropolitan Council. He says many golf courses can overcome that challenge because they have the space for stormwater ponds. But he says Minnesota's changing climate has been delivering yet another challenge. Long dry spells.
Is that going to continue? It's hard to say. I think there will be some big challenges for irrigation if we continue to have that. I mean, how are you going to collect and store the amount of water that you would need to irrigate the golf course for three straight months with no rain?
At the Prestwick Stormwater Pond, several Washington County workers move sandbags with help from a forklift. The pond isn't holding water like it should, and the crew works toward fixing the leak to avoid the worst-case scenario, that the pond becomes a muddy eyesore. Then the golf course might have to use more groundwater just to fill up the pond. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News, Woodbury.
And I'm Phil Picardi, NPR News Update in St. Paul. Thanks for coming along this week. I'm on the Daily Circuit tomorrow. John Wanamaker will have the podcast.